Andy already mentioned, we are finishing up this sermon series today, this series called Recovering the Rest of Sabbath. We've been in it now. This will be the eighth week that we have been doing it, and I hope that you've learned as much or more as I have in preparing these messages. Just one last shout out to Mark Buchanan, who wrote this book called The Rest of God. I've grabbed and expanded upon some of the ideas that he has in this book. If you've enjoyed this content, I recommend this book. I probably didn't even get to half of the things that he has to share, and I think it was written in like 2012, so you can probably get a used copy of it somewhere very, very cheaply at this point. But The Rest of God by Mark Buchanan. And we've been talking about recovering the rest of Sabbath. I hope by this point, though, that you have gotten past, at least bare minimum, past the idea that Sabbath is about a checklist, either about a checklist of doing certain things you have to do or a checklist of not doing certain things that you're not allowed to do. Getting away from that checklist view of Sabbath has been one of the main features of the series, but at the same time, I also want to tell you, please don't be overwhelmed and try and fit everything we've been learning about Sabbath into every Sabbath. Because then you're just going to stumble into another kind of legalism, and you're going to have to restart the whole process all over again. Instead, I would say this. Treat Sabbath as a sort of grand buffet that you are welcome to approach on a regular basis. Now, as with any grand buffet, please don't eat everything every time you go. You'll make yourself sick. It will not be a good experience for you. However, every time you approach this grand buffet of all that Sabbath can be for us, maybe there's something that you need more than others. Pick and choose some of these practices that we've been talking about over the past 8 weeks. We're going to conclude today by talking about having Sabbath vision. And here's what we mean by that. We're talking about at least three different ways that we can spiritually look, three different directions in which we can look when we practice the rest and the stillness of Sabbath. So, three different ways. We're going to start with this one. We're going to talk first about remembering. And remembering is looking back. So what does it mean to remember and to look back as a part of Sabbath? Why is that valuable? Well, I want to start by talking about the fact that we are mere days away from my favorite calendar holiday period. Thanksgiving is coming. Now, yes, I love Christmas. I do. And I love Easter. I love the celebration of Easter. And there are some other more minor holidays that I really enjoy. But man, Thanksgiving. I just don't think it gets better than this, right? And I would be lying if I said it didn't have to do somewhat with the food. It definitely does. I don't know what your favorite thing you're looking forward to is this year. I was listening to a podcast this week where they were going back and forth about their favorite Thanksgiving part of the meal, and somebody said, you know, the typical, like, stuffing. Some other person said noodles. Anybody, like, do noodles at Thanksgiving? Is that okay? So there are some other people out there. Somebody said you take noodles and you cook them with, like, a whole bunch of, like chicken broth and stuff and, like, 6 pounds of butter or something like that. And then you take those noodles and you put them on top of your mashed potatoes and you eat them all together, which just sounds carbolicious to me at this point in time. So yes, the food and also the fact that you can legitimately, if you were so inclined, you could watch football from like noon until like 10 o'clock, 10:30, whatever it happens to be. But I think probably what I love most is the fact that we, unlike we uniquely gather together. Family, friends, we gather together. And one of the things we tend to do when we gather together is we tell stories. We remember together. We retell stories. Actually, just last night, had dinner with all of my siblings and their spouses. I have family visiting from Colorado, so we very rarely get to do this. We all got together and had dinner together. And do you know what we did around the table? We told stories. We remembered. In fact, we retold some stories that all of us already know because they're that good that you need to hear them again. And one of the things I love about Thanksgiving specifically is as families grow, as people are added through engagements and marriages, you get to tell the same stories again because there's a new audience that hasn't even heard the stories yet. Remembering is so important. And we need to be able to spiritually look back and remember as a part of our Sabbath practice. Mark Buchanan in the book, he says it this way. Memory is identity. Memory grounds us in who we are, where we've come from. Memory shapes and guides us. To remember is literally to put broken pieces back together, to remember. There is a terrible cost to our busyness. It erodes memory. Busyness destroys the time we need to remember well. In the confusion, we forget who we are. The broken pieces remain strewn. Remembering well is essential to an authentic, living faith. And I want to pull from one particular Old Testament story to sort of highlight the importance and the value of what it means to remember as a part of a Sabbath practice. It's from the book of Joshua, and what you need to know is this is when the people are about to finally enter into the Promised Land. After being free from Egyptian slavery, wandering out around in the wilderness for years, only hearing about this Promised Land, but now is the time they're going to cross. There's a problem. There's this river in the way. But as God does often, God makes a way. So we pick up the story in Joshua chapter 3. When the people broke camp to cross the Jordan, the priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant went ahead of them. Now, the Jordan is at flood stage all during harvest. Yet, as soon as the priests who carried the Ark reached the Jordan and their feet touched the water's edge, the water from upstream stopped flowing, so the people crossed over opposite Jericho. The priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stopped in the middle of the Jordan and stood on dry ground while all Israel passed by until the whole nation had completed the crossing on dry ground. And when the whole nation had finished crossing the Jordan, the Lord said to Joshua, "Choose 12 men from among the people, one from each tribe, and tell them to take up 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan, from right where the priests are standing, and carry them over with you and put them down at the place where you stay tonight." So Joshua called together the 12 men he had appointed from Israelites, one from each tribe, and he said to them, "Go. Go over before the ark of the Lord, your God, into the middle of the Jordan, and each of you is to take up a stone on his shoulder according to the number of the tribes of the Israelites to serve as a sign among you. In the future, when your children ask, 'What do these stones mean?' Tell them that the flow of the Jordan was cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Lord. When it crossed the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off, and these stones are to be a memorial to the people of Israel forever." So the Israelites did as Joshua commanded them. They took 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan. According to the number of the tribes of the Israelites, as the Lord had told Joshua, they carried them over with them to their camp where they put them down. And Joshua set up the 12 stones that had been in the middle of the Jordan at the spot where the priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant had stood, and they are there to this day. Such a significant moment in the history of God's people. By stepping across the dry ground where the Jordan River once was, they were stepping into not just the Promised Land, but a new identity. They're no longer slaves because they're not in Egypt. They're no longer wanderers because they're not wandering around the wilderness. They are now a new people with a new home. Egypt fades even further into the rear view. I think there's some similarities between this event and what we celebrate as Independence Day in this country, the time when what came before is sort of put behind and you adopt a new identity, you become a new people. And that's what's happening for the people of Israel in this story. And what does Joshua do when he receives word from the Lord and he tells the people, here's what we're going to do. We are going to have one man from each tribe pick up a stone from the middle of the Jordan and carry it to the place where we're going to spend our first night in this new land. Now, based on the story, we don't have 100% accurate idea, but based on the story, if one person is going to be able to carry a stone, it's probably going to be a significant stone. It's not going to be a tiny one, but it has to be carried on a shoulder, so it's probably pretty heavy. So the estimate is these stones were probably each 50 to 75 pounds, most likely. But here's the kicker. Do you know how far they had to carry them? Because I think we envision just out of the Jordan, and we'll set them all down. Well, that's not where they're camping, though. Because if you've ever camped, you know you need for the number of Israelites, they need a very large, flat area to stay. And because of historical geography, we know where they went, and we believe that those stones were carried between 2 and 4 miles. 2 and 4 miles to carry these 50 to 75 pound stones. And what is the purpose? Why is this being done? We read it in the text. It is a sign to you also But then even more importantly, to the generations of children who will come. And when they see them, they will have this question: what do these stones mean? I mean, yeah, anybody who experienced this crossing of the Jordan is going to remember it when they see the stones. But really, the biggest purpose is when these younger generations come through and they see the stones and they didn't experience this Jordan crossing, they're going to say, why are these stones here? It'll be an opportunity of storytelling for future generations, this remembering that we need to do, transferred from one generation to another. Its memory sustained long after the firsthand witnesses were gone. And when I imagine this happening, I imagine a child looking at these stones and saying, what do these stones mean? And I have a feeling that wasn't the only question maybe that they would ask, because I'm not sure if you're aware of this, kids tend to ask a lot of questions. So I can see there being a lot of follow-up questions. What do these stones mean? And they get the answer, wait a minute, why do we need to cross that river? Wait, where were we even coming from? We walked in the wilderness for how long? Why? We got new rules from God? Why do we need new rules and commands? You mean this wasn't the only time we crossed over a river that God held back for us? How do we end up as slaves in Egypt in the first place? And so you can see this is not just a question, but it leads to a cascade of questions that allows for remembering to take place for each successive generation to remember where they have come from. And Sabbath can do that for us today still. It can be a time to halt our busyness and remember what God has done. Remember the captivity we once lived in, but we're now free from. Remember the seasons in the wilderness, maybe even disobedience, when God still remained faithful to us. And to remember how Christ has made a new way through for us. To remember. We look back. We look back and we remember our own lives, the captivity we lived in, that Jesus has freed us from. We remember maybe the seasons of wandering or maybe even seasons of disobedience in our own lives. We remember where we've been, and we remember that Christ has made a way, just as there was a way made through that Jordan. There's an interesting part of Hebrews 10 that gives us one particular thing we might want to remember as part of our Sabbath practice. It simply says this: remember those early days after you had received the light. Mark Buchanan says this in the book: do you remember those early days? Do you remember the moment you knew you were loved with a love that could not be taken or broken or lost? Hold that memory until it's alive, until it assumes its true size and weight and shape, until it reminds you of who you really are. Do you remember the early days when you first received the light? Do you remember when your faith first started to really become your own? I know one of the stories for me in that regard, I think it was the summer between my 8th and 9th grade year of high school, and I was at a friend's youth camp somewhere in the middle of West Virginia. I don't even know where it was. But at the conclusion of camp, they had this tradition, this practice, where they would say, we're going to have 20 minutes of silence. So we'd have our final chapel service, and then all of these teenagers are told to go out, spread out far enough from one another that you can be completely silent, that you might be able to hear if God is speaking to you. I remember as a teenager thinking, boring. I'll play some more games. But I did it because I was a compliant firstborn child, and I did whatever I was told. And I found my spot, and I got to my silence, right? And I remember thinking a couple minutes in, okay, at least I should do this. It's going to be 20 minutes either way. And so I sat there and just kind of said, you know, God, what do you have for me? Because there were some powerful messages that week from a pastor named Kelly Hadlock. I'll never forget him. And he talked about the crucifixion of Jesus, and it rocked my world. And I remember this like it was yesterday. I was just sitting there, like sort of under this tree, and this little ant just starts to crawl across the blades of grass and crawl across my leg. And I remember, like clear as day, no audible voice of God, but God said to me, if I care for this puny, tiny little insect, how much more do you think I care for you? And I remember thinking, probably a lot. That's part of my early days story. What are your early days memories when you were first starting to receive the light, to learn what it meant to follow after Jesus? That's one of the things that we can remember when we look back. A second direction, though, is to look within. This is reflection. So remembering is looking back. Reflection is looking within. ourselves. Think about this for a moment. When you describe yourself to others, maybe somebody you're meeting for the first time, what are the most common ways that you do that? When you're describing, if you're describing yourself to someone for the first time, I think some of those popular ways of doing so are this. We talk about what we do, right? What do you do for a living? What's your job? What's your vocation? We talk about what we do. We also talk about the people we're most closely connected to. I am the husband of, or the spouse of, or this is my mom or my dad or my brothers or sisters or my kids. We talk about those people we're connected to. Sometimes we also talk about where we're from, right? What I find interesting is that all of those things are external to us. Now, yeah, they shape us and form us, but they're all actually external. What we do and who we're closely connected to, I don't know how much of that is actually who we are. Are we reluctant to actually talk about who we are? In the book, Buchanan says, "Who are you?" That we ask that of God and others and of ourselves. It's a question that stands at the heart of a reflective life. We keep asking, though we never get a full or fully satisfying answer this side of heaven. Down here, we see only through a glass darkly. But we're meant to keep asking anyhow, to keep looking all the same. This is the ongoing work of reflection, but reflection flourishes only in rest. We have to ask this question. We have to look within and do this reflection in the midst of rest and stillness. Probably one of the best stories in the Bible about what it looks like to not do reflection well and then to actually learn how to do it well is the story of Jacob in the Old Testament. I probably don't need to recount it. Many of you know the story of Jacob. Mark Buchanan calls him a man with a stolen identity in his book, which I think is interesting. He also says he's a guy who, for most of his story, is taking things, trying to find meaning and validation and identity in these things that he is grabbing after. I mean, think about Jacob's story. Even at birth, what was he doing? Grabbing for the heel of his twin, grabbing onto someone else as a part of his identity. Later in life, think about all the things he takes from Laban. Not one daughter, but two. His best livestock, his household idols. And between his birth and that time with Laban, he took two other very important things from his brother. One of them being his birthright, which we'll just call the soup incident at this point, because I'm not going to get too much into it. But then there's another incident where he steals the blessing intended for his brother Esau. And I think it's in this one that we really see a crystallized view of how poorly Jacob knew who he was, about how poorly he was doing this reflection, this looking within. And that picture up on the screen sort of illustrates a moment in that story. It's in Genesis chapter 27, and if you know the story, you know that Jacob approaches his father, and he does it at whose request? His mom's. So listen, if you think, man, my family's messed up, those Bible families were perfect. No, they're just as messed up as yours, maybe more. So his mom coaxes him to try and step in and steal the blessing of his brother Esau, and so he goes along with it. He approaches his father Isaac, who is at this point, we are told, very old, nearly blind, and probably on his deathbed, and he's wanting to formally bless his eldest son. That is the tradition. That is what is supposed to happen. But Jacob steps in, and he carries this meal that Esau usually makes. And not only that, do you remember what he covers his arms in? You can see a little bit in the painting. He covers his arms in animal skin, because his brother Esau was a very hairy man. And really, the finishing touch, he puts on Esau's clothing. Why? Because it smells like Esau, like the outdoors. And if you read the story, that's the clincher. Because Isaac, I think, is understandably like, all right, I need to really make sure this is the right son. And so, well, this son's bringing me my favorite food that he usually kills for me out in the wilderness. This son feels like Esau, and when he brings him in close, he says, oh, the smell, that's my son Esau, and he blesses. But before he does, he says, who is this? And what does Jacob say? I am Esau, your firstborn son. Obviously being deceptive intentionally, but also based on his life so far, I think we need to just say, I don't think he knows who he is. He doesn't do enough reflection to have any idea who he actually is. But it doesn't stay that way for long. Because in Genesis 32, just a few chapters later, we see Jacob have an experience that completely changes his world. An experience where he has really no choice other than to reflect. He's about to meet his brother, and he's really worried about stuff. He splits up all his possessions and his family and sends them away. And we're seeing the tail end of it here as we pick it up in Genesis 32. During the night, Jacob got up and took his two wives and his two servant wives and his 11 sons and crossed the Jabbok River with them. After taking them to the other side, he sent over all his possessions. This left Jacob all alone in the camp. And a man came and wrestled with him until the dawn began to break. When the man saw that he would not win the match, he touched Jacob's hip and wrenched it out of its socket. And then the man said, "Let me go, for the dawn is breaking." But Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." "What is your name?" the man asked. And he replied, "Jacob." "Your name will no longer be Jacob," the man told him. "From now on, you will be called Israel, because you have fought with God and with men and have won." "Please tell me your name," Jacob said. "Why do you want to know my name?" the man replied, and then he blessed Jacob there. Jacob named the place Peniel, which means the face of God, for he said, "I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been spared." The sun was rising as Jacob left Peniel, and he was limping because of the injury to his hip. Jacob sent everything across the river ahead of him. Wives, sons, all of his possessions. He is now, we are told, all alone, no busyness, no distractions, a time ripe for reflection, to look within. And then a weird thing happens. Out of nowhere, a wrestling match breaks out. All alone, somehow now, Jacob is wrestling a man. Now, of course, we know that it's no mere man. Of course, by the end of the story, we know that Jacob is wrestling who? God himself. I find it fascinating that we read there that this man would not win the match and has to say, "Let me go. Dawn is breaking." Wait a second. God knows he's not going to win? God is begging to be let go? And it reminds me of one of the greatest privileges I have as an uncle, and that is wrestling with my nieces and nephews. It's wonderful. I've been doing it since they were very small. To the point that the family that's visiting from Colorado, my 7-year-old niece, who I only get to see like once a year and who was originally very, very fearful of me, last night I stepped in the house and she saw me across the living room for the first time. "Uncle Pete!" And she runs over and I bend down a little and open my arms for a hug and she stops just short and just, I mean, right there, right to the abdomen, because she knows it's wrestle time, right? And so I take her and shake her upside down and the whole deal. But even though, now, it is true that there is no chance that any of those 7-year-old children have any chance to take me down. Although, I'm getting older and creakier by the year, and I know at some point I'm about to abandon this wrestling thing because it's going to be bad for me. But I know that there's no way they can take me down. However, do you know what sometimes happens in the midst of these wrestling matches? They take me down. They pile on top of me. And why does that happen? I let it happen. And it's not for my benefit. It's for theirs. God, for some reason, lets Jacob get an upper hand in this wrestling match. And it's for Jacob's own benefit to learn who he truly is. It is funny, though, Jacob first saying, "I want a blessing." He's so rich, still trying to take things, right? And the answer, of course, to this demand, "I want a blessing," is, "What is your name?" You can almost hear that question ring out in the darkness, can't you? In that loneliness. And it's a question that doesn't just ring through space, but also time for a man with a stolen identity. "What is your name?" And what does Jacob say? He could say anything at this point. In the past, he said Esau. But in that moment, he chooses honesty and says, "My name is Jacob." And he claims not only his name, but everything that has gone along with it, all of the clutching and the deception and the double crossing, all the true lack of self-knowledge and unwillingness to be reflective, to look within. He owns all of it. I am Jacob. But here's the thing. In that moment when he is most honest and most vulnerable with this wrestling partner, that's when God steps forward and says, let me start telling you who you really are. You're no longer Jacob. You're Israel. Now, that doesn't make anything go away that Jacob did. It doesn't change his past, but it certainly changes the trajectory of his future to receive this new name and the wounding that goes along with it. If you read the rest of Jacob's story, you'll see that he doesn't act like old Jacob again. It's a completely new direction for his life. And we can use Sabbath in the same way if we're willing to look within and to be reflective. When we use Sabbath as a time to pause and reflect, when we use that stillness to look inside, we give God opportunity to remind us we don't have to be who we've been. We can receive new identities. In fact, 2 Corinthians says we can be new creations. We don't have to be who we've been because of what Christ has done for us. And made a way for us, not by parting the waters, but by giving himself a broken body and his poured out blood. So we look back in remembrance, we look within in reflection, and then there's one more. We look ahead in anticipation. Remembering is important, reflecting is important, but it can't stop there. Because Sabbath is also a foretaste of what is yet to come. Buchanan puts it this way, anticipation completes the journey that begins with memory and sojourns in reflection. Anticipation is that journey's destination. I don't have to sit here and tell you that even though you are a new creation, you still live in a world that is rather imperfect, to put it nicely. You are still imperfect, and we live in a world that is still imperfect. There are things that have yet to be made right, but I have good news for you, because God is not done making things right. Hebrews 12 talks about this a little bit in some sort of apocalyptic language that also hails back to the Old Testament. We read in Hebrews 12, at that time his voice shook the earth, but now he has promised, once more I will shake not only the earth, but also the heavens. The words once more indicate removing of what can be shaken, that is, created things, so that what cannot be shaken may remain. Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us be thankful. And so worship God acceptably with reverence and with awe, for our God is a consuming fire. So a little background on this passage to understand it more deeply. The reason it ends with our God is a consuming fire, if you read the full context of what's happening here, it is a contrast between God's self-revelation at Sinai, when the law was delivered to the people, and God's self-revelation in Christ. And that self-revelation at Sinai was full of the earth, like the earth was shaking. The mountain was trembling. And if you read the context of the passage, it's a lot of darkness and gloom and storm, and don't come any closer to the mountain. We're told that Moses was terrified and trembling with fear. Compare that to the self-revelation of God in Christ, where it talks about thousands of angels in joyful assembly. It's an invitation. Come close to this God who is the judge. Why? So he can sprinkle you with the blood and make you holy and perfect. A big contrast between these two self-revelations of God. And he shook the earth at Sinai. And then using the words from the prophet Haggai, it says God is going to shake things again, and not just the earth, but the earth and the heavens. In fact, all created things will be shaken. I think this lines up with the passage in Revelation 21, verse 4, where it says that there's coming a time when the old order of things will pass away, will be shaken off. But there is one thing that cannot be shaken. All created things can be shaken, but there's one thing that can't be, and it's a kingdom. It's an unshakable kingdom, a kingdom established in Christ that we can receive now in part, but is yet to be fully revealed. And a Sabbath is an opportunity in stillness to anticipate, to look ahead to when God will finish making things new. And I tried to figure out, how do I want to talk about this today? And then I remembered a scene from probably my favorite book by my favorite author. The book is called The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis. And it's this sort of, it's a metaphor about looking at what it's like for those who are not yet heavenly to visit the heavenly place. And in the book, basically, those who are not heavenly have an opportunity to take a bus ride to heaven and to experience it. We read about their experience there. And the author, Randy Alcorn, puts it this way. He says, in The Great Divorce, C.S. Lewis sees everything in heaven, whether it's grass or rocks or trees or water, as much more solider than things in the country that those folks came from. It's heavy and hard like diamonds. The characters can't even pluck a flower or pick up a leaf. The grass is sharp and hard for them to walk on. All of this is in contrast to these people who themselves now appear to be transparent and even ghostly. They thought their world was the real one, the one with substance, and that heaven was sort of a less substantial spiritual world. And they learn, if their eyes are open to see, that they had it backwards, that heaven is actually the land of substance and earth is the land of shadow, the land of illusions and pretensions. Heaven itself is the reality. And to fit into heaven, they must become not less solid, but actually more. They must move from being phantoms to having weight and substance. They are shallow people who must become deeper and weightier. So I say all of that to say this. Friends, there is a time coming that we anticipate during the stillness of Sabbath where God will make all things new and our experience will be more real than reality. Whatever we experience today, even the best of it, will pale in comparison, because there is coming a time when God will make everything so new and Jesus will redeem all things, and it will be even more real. And you're like, I don't understand that. I don't fully understand it either. There's some mystery involved, but I promise you, that's what we anticipate. We remember, we reflect, but then we anticipate, because Sabbath is a foretaste of when everything fully made new is dripping with the presence of God. And what joy lies ahead for us.